It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as the Trump administration looks to change foreign trade deals, we'll look at how important exports are for Wisconsin's economy. First, we take our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Primaries in four states last night set up races for Congress in the fall. Gina Haspel is moving closer to being confirmed as director of the CIA, and House Speaker Paul Ryan is under pressure from Republicans to put new immigration bills to a vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the nomination of Gina Haspel as CIA director? Should senators vote to confirm her despite concerns raised over her connection with practices like waterboarding in the past? And with immigration continuing to be a tough issue for Congress, what solution do you want to see, especially when it comes to the so-called Dreamers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. He covers Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Scott, let's start with some of the primary elections around the state. We had Nebraska, Pennsylvania, Idaho, and Oregon. What stood out to you? What were you watching?
I think a lot of the attention was on Pennsylvania. In terms of the Senate, on the Senate side, we saw a Trump-backed congressman named Lou Barletta win his Senate GOP primary. He will square off against incumbent Democrat Bob Casey. In the fall, this is going to be a big race with lots of money, outside money pouring in, which will, you know, in part be part of the battle for control of the Senate. In terms of on the House side, this was the first election that we saw the newly drawn congressional districts that were upheld this year by the courts, and that tended to move in the Democrats' favor. We saw a number in the suburbs outside of Philadelphia. We saw a number of Democrats win nominations. Many of them were women. I think that's an interesting thing to note, including one who I heard on one of your NPR shows this morning, Chrissy Houlihan. She is an Air Force veteran, a teacher. She is the type of candidate who Democrats like to recruit, and so she will most likely be serving in Congress, given that Republicans don't have a very strong candidate they're putting up in that seat. So I think the question is, where is the excitement heading into the fall election? If you look at who the Democrats are nominating in these races, it looks like they're women of all sorts of backgrounds. The question is whether Democrats have that excitement, or if Trump can sort of stir up the conservative base and get his voters to turn out at the polls.
And in November, people are going to be watching Pennsylvania a lot. It sounds like Democrats feel they underperformed there in the presidential election 2016. And those new maps you mentioned set by the state Supreme Court. If Democrats want to take control of the House, they need a lot of these Pennsylvania seats to swing their way, right?
That's right. There's a lot of open seats in Pennsylvania this year because of retirements, because of some resignations. And so Pennsylvania really is up for grabs. We could see the delegation, if Democrats have a really great year, we could see the delegation go from a very Republican delegation to a more of a Democratic delegation. And also, I would point out, I forgot to mention that the delegation is currently, or for the last few years, has been all male. So the fact that Democrats have nominated a number of women for these seats is significant, and we will likely see that composition of the delegation shift come November.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's move to the Gina Haspel nomination as director of the CIA. She had these Senate hearings this last week, I think. A lot of questions raised about torture, about waterboarding and black site prisons. It seemed maybe up in the air whether or not she might be confirmed. Some news this week, it looks a lot more likely, right?
That's right. I mean, it looks like she does, in fact, have the votes to clear the full Senate. Earlier today, she cleared the Intelligence Committee. Her nomination did on a 10-5 vote behind closed doors. And just yesterday, three Democrats got on board, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Bill Nelson of Florida. Both of those two have tough races later this fall, as well as the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner. That brings to five the number of Democrats who are now supporting her nomination. It looks like that will put her over the top, you know, even though she does have a couple GOP defections. One thing that really did help her confirmation or her nomination was this letter that she sent to Democrats addressing some of those concerns about her past involvement in waterboarding and some of those harsh interrogation techniques, what John McCain certainly would call torture. She disavowed and distanced herself from some of those tactics, and that seemed to do the trick and appease folks like top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner.
That had been a big issue for some Democrats questioning her. They made the case that she was really dodging their questions about the moral rightness of those actions in the past, whether they could happen again. Some Democrats came out of those hearings saying our questions weren't really answered. This letter has done it at least for Senator Mark Warner.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And you know, that's not to say that many Democrats will vote no against her. I mean, a number of the liberals who are already sort of eyeing 2020 contests, people like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and many others, are expected to be no votes. Dianne Feinstein came out strongly against Haspel. So Democrats, more and more Democrats will be in the no category. But again, she only needs a handful of Democrats to join Republicans, and it looks like that could either head to the Senate floor later this week or sometime early next week.
And the president's security and foreign policy team has seen some big changes lately. Now John Bolton in as national security advisor. The previous CIA director, Mike Pompeo, he's now Secretary of State. This is a big change. Is there an idea that now that these pieces are in place, we'll see stability in the foreign policy and security arena in the White House?
I think the Pompeo move from CIA to Secretary of State was very significant. Already this week, he has indicated that he is beginning to staff up the State Department. That had been a huge concern from Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, that under Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, that he was not really filling these key positions, diplomatic positions around the world, and that the United States message and diplomacy was not reaching some of our partners around the world. Pompeo, who is very close to President Trump and in fact, met with the North Korean leader very recently and has been sort of facilitating this Trump-Kim summit coming up. He's very trusted by the president, and he has one of his first moves as Secretary of State has been to sort of reverse what Tillerson was doing with the State Department and starting to fill some of these vacant positions throughout his agency.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, about some of the week's top news out of Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, should Congress pass new immigration bills trying to address the status of Dreamers, people brought into the country illegally as youth, here now kind of in limbo? Join in with your answer to that question at 800-642-1234. Also, do you think Speaker Paul Ryan, when he's replaced as either Speaker or Minority Leader next year, should a more conservative Republican get that spot? And should the White House issue an apology to Senator John McCain over leaked comments? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Right now, we continue our talk with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at the week's top stories in national politics. And Scott, immigration coming up in the U.S. House, kind of this maverick movement to try to get a vote on various bills, even though Speaker Ryan doesn't want this to happen right now. What's going on?
Well, what we're seeing is a handful of moderate Republicans who are trying to go around Speaker Ryan and their leadership team and force a series of immigration votes, specifically having to do with DACA, the children who were brought to the country illegally by their parents. President Trump, as you remember, rolled back that President Obama DACA program. And so these are moderate Republicans who are trying to force some kind of action on immigration. So far, we have not seen anything move through the House of Representatives this year. And all they need to do is get 218 signatures. Democrats said they will join that effort, but that Republicans need to bring along 25 of their own members in order to force these votes. So far, they have 20, and so they're five short. And so it's a very tense moment on Capitol Hill right now as we wait to see whether these moderate Republicans can get these five additional supporters.
And Scott, I've been watching you on Twitter. You have this discharge petition watch going on as more people come in. They could be happening now. Thanks for taking time away from that. I want to give a listen to Speaker Ryan. He says, hey, let's not jump the gun here. They're doomed to get vetoed by President Trump. Here's a listen to him talking about it this week.
That's what we're working on right now, is what is a bill that deals with DACA and deals with all those security other issues that can get some Democrats and get a presidential signature. Going down a path and having some kind of a spectacle on the floor that just results in a veto doesn't solve a problem. We actually would like to solve this problem, and that is why I think it's important for us to come up with a solution that the president can support.
And critics have pointed out that the House voted to repeal Obamacare over 60 times while Obama was president. So even if this is a symbolic bill, maybe do it. So what happens procedurally, Scott, if these Democrats and a handful of Republicans, 25, sign these petitions? What's next?
Well, what's next would be another process called Queen of the Hill, and basically the House of Representatives would debate and then vote on four separate immigration bills, going from very more liberal bills to a Trump proposal to something else more conservative known as the Goodlatte-McCall bill, named after the Judiciary and Homeland Security chairman. That bill would provide allow DACA recipients to temporarily remain in the United States, but it would also come with more aggressive border enforcement measures as well as some cuts to legal immigration programs. And so basically what Speaker Ryan is saying is that give us a little bit more time to work with the president to come to some kind of solution that will be amenable to both moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, as well as something that can get the president's signature. However, these DACA supporters, especially the Republican DACA supporters who are feeling the heat at the ballot, believe that they've given the speaker enough time already and that he's failed to act, and that's why they're prepared to force this action.
Right, those negotiations happened quite a while back, didn't they? There was that big cameras on people from both chambers of Congress in with the president, negotiating on camera, and really nothing ended up coming out of that.
That's right. This is an issue that's been sort of simmering for a number of months. And as I mentioned, as we sort of tick closer and closer to Election Day, these moderate Republicans are really feeling the heat from their Democratic opponents. Many of these moderates come from Hispanic heavy districts, districts that are, you know, deal with agriculture and other issues, and so this is a top priority for them, and they need something done on this issue in order to survive in November.
At a procedural level, for procedure nerds, this is pretty exciting stuff, but even if they do get something passed in the House, then it would have to get bought into in the Senate, and then, as Speaker Ryan was saying, the president would have to sign off on it. It doesn't seem that likely that anything that happens today is going to result in actual law being passed, does it?
I think that's right. I think the reason we're in this situation in the first place in dealing with gridlock is because it's been so hard to find that sweet spot, something the president can sign into law, something that Democrats and Republicans can agree on and get through both chambers. And so even if in Queen of the Hill, the bill that receives the most number of votes over this magic number of 218 would be the one to advance to the Senate. But again, the Senate would cause all sorts of problems, and Mitch McConnell may not want to exactly deal with immigration just a handful of months before Election Day.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about some of the top stories in national politics. Here's one right smack in the middle of your beat, Scott. The question of who is going to follow Speaker Paul Ryan as the leader of House Republicans. He has said he's not running again in November. He's going to, as far as we know now, finish out his term in Congress and as Speaker. But then there's that big question mark. Who's running the show for Republicans after that? What do we know?
Well, there's so many question marks right now. What we know is that Speaker Ryan has endorsed Kevin McCarthy, his top deputy and the majority leader, to succeed him as Speaker of the House. But what we don't know is who is going to retain control of the House of Representatives come November. Will it be the Republicans or will Democrats take it back? In that instance of Democrats, if they are successful in November, many Republicans are raising the question of, do we stick with the same team that basically turned over the majority to the Democrats, or do we go in a completely different direction? And if the answer is going in a different direction, do we go with somebody much more conservative? One name that has continued to crop up time and again is Jim Jordan. He's the founding chairman of the very conservative Freedom Caucus. This is the Freedom Caucus that basically ousted or pushed out Speaker Boehner back in 2015. That led to the rise of Speaker Ryan of Wisconsin. And so this is a debate that is happening sort of, you know, behind the scenes right now. Is does the conference go with the same team or does it go in a different direction? Obviously, many of those answers won't be known until November when the election is decided.
Speaking of being a procedure nerd, Scott, check me on this. If I want to be the Speaker of the House, I need to win a majority of the votes in the full House of Representatives. If I want to be minority leader for my party, I need a majority of people from my party in the House. And those are very different votes, right?
That's exactly right. Very few people can reach 218 votes to be Speaker of the House. That's the number of votes you need on the House floor. But in order to be minority leader, you just need half of your conference, which could be as few as 90 or 95 votes. That'd be like half of 180. And so that's a much lower threshold. That's something that many Republicans think somebody like Jim Jordan could achieve, even though they say Jim Jordan could never get to 218 because there'd be so many moderate Republicans against him. But that is another interesting dynamic in this whole scenario is, whether we're talking about the Speaker of the House and 218 votes or minority leader, which is a much lower threshold.
And the behind-the-scenes politicking is going on now, and that question of who's going to be voting and what they're running for won't be known until after Election Day in November.
That's right. Usually the internal leadership elections come a couple weeks after Election Day, so it will be sometime in mid-November. And then in early January, they will have the formal vote for Speaker of the House on the House floor. We don't know if that will be for a Democrat or Republican yet. And the Democrats are grappling with their own problems, trying to figure out if they stick with Nancy Pelosi or go in an entirely different direction with somebody a little bit younger, somebody like Joe Crowley of New York. So that's for another day.
And lastly, Scott, reports this week that a White House staffer made a joke about Senator John McCain, saying it doesn't matter, McCain's opposition to Gina Haspel, CIA director, saying it doesn't matter, he's dying anyway. Now, that was leaked to the press. Here's Press Secretary Sarah Sanders being asked about that incident this week.
Does the White House not think that you need to condemn these remarks or comment?
Again, I'm not going to validate a leak one way or the other out of an internal staff meeting.
Are you saying that you didn't say this?
Again, I'm not going to validate a leak out of an internal staff meeting one way or the other.
Scott, what do you make of this story? People talking about what was said on the one hand and the White House talking about it being leaked on the other.
Well, I'll give a plug for my own publication, The Hill, which broke that story last week. Some of our White House reporters broke that story. We didn't know it was going to turn into such a big story and snowball, but it has sort of survived the last five or six news cycles. And I think part of the reason is because the White House, and specifically the President of the United States, has refused to apologize for these comments, basically dismissing John McCain and saying his opinions on Gina Haspel and the CIA don't matter because he's dying anyway, was the quote from this White House staffer. I think a lot of lawmakers are sort of scratching their head on Capitol Hill saying, why don't they just go ahead and issue the apology at this point? Trump and the White House are very dug in, and it doesn't look like any sort of apology is coming. That's sort of been the MO from this White House. They're very allergic to apologies, and we have not seen the president apologize too often. I can't remember when he has issued one in the past. So I think that's why this story has sort of stayed alive and penetrated through so many news cycles.
Have we heard from Senator McCain himself or his family on this? Of course, he's not in the Senate now. He's has this very aggressive form of brain cancer. Have we heard from his family on this?
We've heard in very strong terms from his daughter, Meghan McCain, who is on The View, is a regular guest on The View, and she has spoken with a number of White House officials and has been demanding an apology and has sort of stuck up for her father, and she says, you know, she won't go away until she gets some sort of justice for her father. She has a loud microphone on Twitter and on television. And so, McCain has a number of allies. But again, yesterday, President Trump was on Capitol Hill meeting, having lunch with senators, and not one senator, asked him to apologize directly to his face. So that sort of tells you a little bit about what that relationship is like between Republicans and the president. Many are fearful of the president and don't want to cross him and get on his bad side.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for a weekly look at the top news from the nation's capital. One of President Trump's top priorities in office has been dealing with foreign trade. He's taken aim at major trade deals like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the U.S. is in the middle of major trade talks with China. So what could all of these changes to trade deals mean for Wisconsin's economy? In a recent piece for Wiscontext.org, our next guest investigated just how much Wisconsin exports and where those Wisconsin-made products are going. Stephen Deller is professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He's also interim director of the Center for Community and Economic Development at UW-Extension. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, you co-wrote this piece, How Big a Deal Are Exports Coming Out of Wisconsin?
It is a surprisingly large market. One of the things that really kind of surprised us is that we kind of know that we export a lot. We have a lot of trading with Canada and Mexico and increasingly China and Japan. But what surprised us is the number of countries that we don't have export relationships with. It is Wisconsin is exporting to almost every country in the world.
And when people think Wisconsin's exporting stuff, what pops into my head are agricultural products, soybeans, cranberries, dairy products. When it comes to the value, they're out there, but that's not where the big money is coming into the state.
No, the big money is in actually the one sector that we export the most is airplane parts. And you would think that that would not be a Wisconsin product, but there are a number of manufacturers, particularly up in the Fox Valley area, that are making airplane parts, not for large airplanes, but for smaller airplanes. Kind of the Whitman Airport and the Experimental Aircraft Association type of market up there. And you wouldn't think that that would be a huge market for the Wisconsin economy, but it is.
And then really specialized medical technology looks like it's a big deal for us, too.
It is. Wisconsin used to be a major, and I think the company has moved its production facility, but Wisconsin used to be the major producer of surgical equipment. So a scalpel or anything like that was made by a company in Milwaukee. And it had a international market.
Now, the things we're talking about and some of the other durable goods and manufactured products, when you stack them up to something like those soybeans or cranberries, I'm guessing we export a lot more volume of those agricultural products, but just that one piece of airplane equipment, say, is going to bring in a lot of cash.
Exactly. It's higher value products that we're shipping out. But when you think about the actual volume, I mean, container ships moving over, it's actually agricultural products like soybeans.
Now, looking at the current world of trade agreements, like how important are deals like NAFTA as far as enabling that trade you mentioned to Canada and Mexico, or other agreements that are sending things overseas to China or Japan or Europe going in the other direction?
I think it's extremely important. Businesses in Wisconsin have kind of three markets. One is kind of the local market, and that's what they're, you know, think a beauty shop or a hardware store or something like that. Then there are companies that have a larger kind of state market, regional market. They're trying to get in the Chicago market. They're trying to get into the Twin Cities market. And then there's a third type, which is really kind of expanding into, you know, going into Atlanta, Denver, Toronto. Why not go to Toronto? Or why not go to Vancouver? Why not go to Mexico City? Well, now all of a sudden, it's a different ballgame because it's an international trade. So what a lot of these trade policies are trying to do is to make it just as easy to market to Mexico City or Tokyo or Berlin as it is to market to, say, Atlanta or Denver.
Now, as President Trump attacks some of these trade deals, this is maybe getting a bit beyond what you wrote, but the idea isn't so much that, okay, we don't export stuff. It's that the playing field isn't level, so that, yeah, we're making money in Wisconsin when we export all this stuff, but the unfairness, as the president describes it, of trade deals means that foreign companies have an easier time coming here and selling stuff to us than we have going out and selling stuff to them.
Well, it depends on if they're playing by the rules of the game. And I think that's where we get a disagreement. I think one of the things is that you have to think about what our comparative advantage is. And if you're thinking about, I want to buy, you know, inexpensive socks to go running in, that's just, I don't want to spend a lot of money on that stuff. And those are the types of products that, you know, a lot of developing countries have a comparative advantage in. So what our niche is that we want to go higher end. We want to go to that higher value product that we can charge more for, and that's a market for us. That's different than saying that they're not playing by the rules. And that's one of the issues that the Trump administration and previous administration has had, is that a lot of our trading partners don't necessarily follow our patent laws. They don't necessarily follow our copyright laws. Now, that's a different issue.
Talking to Steve Deller, economist at UW-Madison, looking at the value of exports for Wisconsin's economy. People are worried that we're going to end up in a trade war as we put up tariffs on particular products like steel and aluminum was one that came up. We withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership before it really got up and rocking, renegotiating NAFTA with threats of dropping out. How vulnerable is Wisconsin? How much could our economy be hurt if there are tariffs against our products in retaliation?
Oh, it could hit us very hard, because you look at where a lot of our growth potential is, particularly if you look at our agricultural products. The growth market for our commodity, which would be soybeans or commodity cheese or things like that, is the international markets. And if a company decides they want to get into those international markets, there's a fair amount of work there. Now, the state does have a lot of programs to help companies make that transition, but there's anything that raises uncertainty about, if I want to go into the Taiwan market, for example, and now there's some uncertainty over trade policies because politicians are playing games, that really creates a lot of risk and uncertainty for me, and that puts a damper on my ability to grow my business.
One more thing you looked at in the Wis Context piece that you co-wrote was where in Wisconsin these exports are coming from. And no surprise, the Milwaukee area is the biggest part of the state population-wise. A lot of the exports have come from there. But you looked at other metropolitan areas in the state that have seen growth in exports. What are you looking at?
What we're trying to do is to essentially say, you would think, well, it's Milwaukee, right? Because a lot of the big manufacturing firms are in Milwaukee, in the Milwaukee metro area, but it's actually much broader than that. You get up into almost every single metropolitan area in the state of Wisconsin, whether it be Janesville or La Crosse or Eau Claire, actually is part of that export market. You even get into, it's almost 35%, depending on which year you look at, is actually coming out of rural Wisconsin. Now, how much of that is agricultural products? We haven't been able to cut the data that way. It's not provided that kind of detail.
Now, looking big picture at how exports have risen and fallen in Wisconsin over the years, some of it's outside the control in some ways of trade policy or what we do here in the state. You see drops no surprise when there was the big recession, the big global recession. And also, a lot of it, you write, varies depending on the value of the dollar.
Oh, that's right. If we have a strong dollar, that makes our ability to export all that much better. But if the dollar, do I have that right?
Other way,
it's
right?
The other way around. Yeah. Thank you.
Our dollar,
if our dollar is weak, that makes our exports a lot more competitive. But if the dollar becomes stronger, we're kind of, it goes against us. The problem is that we have very little control over that. A lot of that has to do with interest rates, monetary policy, and, you know, essentially where are people wanting to put their funds? And that's a part of the risk that some companies are better positioned to deal with and some others are not.
So what are you watching for as these negotiations over NAFTA? There's a deadline tomorrow, actually, that I think we're going to be talking about on the show, a deadline tomorrow on enough of a deal that it can go to Congress and get approved in time for the elections. What are you watching for with NAFTA in particular?
I hope that cooler heads prevail. One of the things that is worrying me is that there's a lot of elected officials that realize that free trade is actually a good policy. It's the right thing to do. I think that's one thing that has strong bipartisan support, is that we want free trade. But they're thinking that we can play political games with it. We can get political points by playing around with this stuff. And that's playing with dynamite, because you can really negatively impact a lot of businesses throughout the U.S. and in Wisconsin.
One argument I've seen, though, is that, okay, yes, maybe free trade overall does help. It lowers prices for consumers, creates jobs, but in particular areas, in particular sectors, some people are really genuinely hurt by free trade. Their factory closed, their local source of their economy closed. Has the United States done enough to mollify that, to help people who are hurt by free trade?
I think that one could argue no. If you're the person that was, you know, fifth generation in the garment industry in North Carolina, now suddenly the garment industry is gone. That can be very difficult to transition out of that. Part of the problem that we have is that folks aren't as mobile as they used to be. So if the garment industry in North Carolina leaves and there's a growing industry in another part of the U.S., move to that other part. That's easier said than done. So one of the things we have to think about is what is the short-term kind of impacts and what are the long-term benefits? And I think the long-term benefits will outweigh the short-term negative impacts. The problem is that you feel those negative impacts right now. You're worried about paying the rent now, not whether or not I have greater potential 10 years from now.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Deller, professor and the interim director of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about an essay he co-wrote for WisContext, looking at the importance of exports in Wisconsin's economy. You can read more at wiscontext.org. Right now, the construction business in much of Wisconsin is doing pretty well, and that means a lot of job opportunities for those in the skilled trades. Despite that, women only make up about 5% of trade workers in the state, about 4% nationwide. Our next guest is trying to break down some of the stereotypes about these jobs and get more women involved. If you're a woman in construction, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Share your story, what led you to pursue that line of work, what your experience has been like, what you would tell other women about getting into the trades. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sandy Thistle is the co-program director for Madison College's Construction and Remodeling Program. She's with us in our studio. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to join you, Rob. Thank you.
I want to start with your story. You got into the skilled trades yourself. Did it seem like a natural fit for you originally, or did it take some convincing?
So in retrospect, perfect fit. Okay, but I want to say in the early 80s, when I was in high school, senior of high school, it was either nursing or teaching. Mm-hmm. If you were an academically successful girl, that's what you did. And so I came here to the UW to study nursing. And there was no more thought put into picking nursing than that. It's what people push me toward. And it wasn't really a thing that spoke to me. And so I lived here. I spent some time figuring out who I was. And in the meantime, did a lot of athletic things. And some of the women, two of the women that I met through that, started carpentry apprenticeships with the union. And I thought, oh, I'll give that a go. If I don't like it, I'll quit. And then the retrospect part is my whole life I was sort of an athlete. And so I was physically active. That made me really happy. And I loved math. And so from that perspective, it's an obvious fit. And the funny thing about it is that my daughter is taking the program that I teach, though I'm mostly not her teacher. And she graduated from East High 2 years ago. And she said the same thing, that the counselors direct the girls toward the arts and the boys toward the wood shop. So it's sad to hear that things haven't really changed that much.
So it's interesting. It's for a girl, say, at the high school level, it's not on her radar maybe personally, but also it's being kept off her radar in a lot of ways because nobody's thinking of girls going into these skilled trades.
Well, and I think that's the other part is, right, you are more comfortable thinking about doing things that you see other people like you doing, right? And so there's 5% or less women in the skilled trades. There's no exposure. So it's not on anybody's radar. And in fact, for boys and girls, it's for the entire time I've been in, known as a best-kept secret, the apprenticeship in the skilled trades.
Now, for boys or girls, this is real work. This can be a demanding work, depending on the job and the particular job site in some ways. What is it about that you and your colleagues, men and women, love?
You hit it on the head, right? My first job when I was about 17 or 18 was in an insurance office sitting at a desk. And I recall holding my eyes open and thinking, what is wrong with me that I can't stay awake for this job? And the flip side of that is physical work. And I don't have any problem staying awake doing physical work. And as an athlete, like, I kind of groove on the challenge of using my body to accomplish things that are hard. And it just makes me really happy and drives me.
Now, the stereotype is that this isn't work that women would want to do. There's another stereotype, I think, that this kind of work, these kind of work sites aren't going to be friendly to women coming in and wanting to do these jobs. What did you find?
You know, I've been doing this almost 30 years, and my experience has changed and varied depending on the crew and the company. And I still strongly believe that the people at the top of the company set a tone. They either believe that women belong there or they don't. And if they believe women belong there, then they're waiting for us to succeed. And if they don't, they're often looking for us to fail. And that perspective is huge in whether we succeed, especially if there's one woman or one African-American man, everyone is watching everything that they do versus a white guy who doesn't succeed. That doesn't mean anything about white guys. So, you know, I think really the solution is you have to get more people who aren't white guys into the skilled trades for any of it to change.
And do you get still maybe the double take? Like people, wait, that's not what I imagined this skilled trades person was going to look like.
Well, it's funny because last year I had a student who said to me one day in class, he's sort of all sprawled out, this young 18-year-old white guy from rural Wisconsin. And he's like, is John the head of the program? And I said, why do you ask that? And he said, well, you know, because he looks like he's the head. And I'm like, you mean because he's a tall white guy? And he just sort of went, whoa. And regularly still, there are assumptions made based on my appearance. But, you know, after that many years, I can take care of myself, and I know how to get the attention I need.
Talking to Sandy Thistle, co-program director for Madison College's Construction and Remodeling Program, about women in skilled trades here in Wisconsin. Sandy, let's talk about the program and how you are reaching out to people, maybe people who don't fit the stereotype of people who would go into the skilled trades.
We hired about 3 years ago Jen Wojcik, who knows lots of people in the community, and she started her apprenticeship 1 year before I did. And she grew up here, and so she has tons of connections, and she's been developing those connections. So in the high schools, in the middle schools, at job fairs, connected to employers. I mean, she's really taken that angle off in terms of our students and their access to employers and internships and with a focus on getting more non-traditional folks into the program. And this year, I want to say it was 50% young or 50% white men and 13% women and 15% Hispanic workers and 15% African Americans. So we've got a lot of diversity in our program, which makes for a really fantastic group.
A demand for skilled trade work, it goes up and down some with the economy, but is this a good job to have in general, money-wise? Is this a good job to have right now?
That was key to my entering the skilled trades. I wanted to have family-supporting wages so that I had real choices in my life, and I've always had those choices because my income is such that it allows that. I can live where I want. I have access. What was the second part of your question?
Like right now, is there a lot of demand for this?
It's insane, and they're expecting it to be that way on into the future. They cannot get enough bodies to fill the positions.
Now, suppose a woman, young woman, or I guess a not-so-young woman is listening right now thinking, I never thought about this. I'm curious now. I don't know what it would take around the state. What would you recommend as first steps to check this out?
The typical thing of interviews, following people around while they do their job to get a better understanding of what it is. I am always happy to talk to any woman about what I do and what my history is. Our program is one option. We're a one-year program. We have full and part-time students and or carpentry apprenticeship.
And for those school counselors out there thinking, maybe I haven't been pointing people in that direction, maybe even girls or boys for that matter, what do you say to them?
The obvious choice are athletic individuals. If they are competitive in the field and like the challenge of physicality, this could be a great fit. And girls who have mechanical thinking and math skills.
And are you looking for new recruits for the program for next fall right now?
We are always looking for new recruits. We're looking to be pretty full next year, but we have a great program.
And are you seeing things like this, more people paying attention to this around the state, just briefly?
There is an initiative around the state called Pathways Wisconsin. The Department of Public Instruction is involved in that, and they're piloting ways to introduce an easier pathway that's more catered to these kinds of occupations for kids starting as early as middle school.
Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Sandy Thistle, co-program director for Madison College's Construction and Remodeling Program. She's with us to talk about what it might take to get more women working in the skilled trades, construction fields, and others. You can still share your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Or if you're a woman who's gone into these trades, give us a quick tweet @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know what got you into it, how it's going for you. If you spent any time online today, you may have seen and heard this. Here's a listen.
Laurel. Laurel.
Okay, now you just heard a word. Now, a lot of you will hear what I heard, which is the word Laurel. But apparently, a lot of people are hearing the word Yanny. Not really even a word, just those two syllables together. This is like the dress, what color is the dress thing from a couple years back. People on both sides of this thing genuinely convinced they heard one or the other, and it can't believe that anybody heard something different. I hear nothing but the word Laurel there. Now, we've got a lot of sound people here. Aubrey Ralph, one of our engineers, found some theories about this and broke it down into different frequencies. Now, here's a low frequency that is more prone to lead to Laurel. Here's a listen.
Laurel. Laurel.
Okay, that's just the lower Laurel frequency of that. Now let's listen to the higher frequency, above 3.34 kilohertz, he tells me. So it sounds kind of like yally, maybe yanny. And so what people think is going on here, a couple things. Sounds, they happen in all sorts of frequencies at once. If you are maybe a little older or spent time in a rock band like me, you don't hear those higher frequencies, you just hear the Laurel part. A lot of other people with better hearing at that higher range hear the Yanny. Let us know what you heard. Tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.